Okay, good evening. It's Tuesday, September 25th. This week's share by Rabbi Feldman is sponsored by Arlene and Michael Sand to commemorate the yard site of Michael's mother, Mrs. Heinel Sand, Hensha Bas Rebichiel Mechel, whose yard site was today.
Good evening. So I thought maybe what we'll do, maybe a little briefly, we'll play it by ear, is maybe this is a bridge from last week's topic into a future topic and connecting a little bit Yom Kippur and Sukkot along the way. Towards the end of last week's topic, we tried to stuff in another idea right before the clock closed about how we relate to the Inuyim of Yom Kippur in general, a broader concept of the Inuyim beyond eating and drinking. And as you mentioned, it could affect the question of how we relate to children and Yom Kippur. And that question is part of a broader discussion on which maybe we could talk about in greater detail in the future, and maybe we'll just kind of introduce right now. But the topic of chinuch as a specific mitzvah, chinuch is a general overall value, and it's one of the central values clearly of Judaism as a whole, but it's also a specific rabbinical mitzvah of chinuch, which means more directly to train children in specific mitzvahs, has certain applications on Yom Kippur, has many applications on Sukkot. A lot of the discussion of chinuch actually comes from Sukkot sources, and maybe we'll touch upon that in a minute, just again to bring it into our Sukkot context. And then maybe after Sukkot, maybe we'll discuss the concept in general. But basically, we'll just mention, first of all, it comes up in the beginning of the Gemara and the Sukkot of Sukkot, because for figuring out some of the details of Sukkot, the Gemara quotes Hilini Malka. The Gemara relates a story involving Queen Hilini. So the Gemara says, well, it's not really a great source because women are not really obligated in Sukkot. So why are we learning from how she related to mitzvah Sukkot? So the Gemara says, well, she actually had 7 sons, and that's what she was worried about. And in the discussion of the Gemara about sons who were over our mitzvah, sons who were really beneath our mitzvah. And in that context, we get to the concept of the obligation of a parent to train children of a certain age in mitzvah, so a certain age being before the age of 13 or 12, because otherwise they're adults, but not being at age zero, because presumably they don't understand that much age zero, although I'm pretty shocked at what kids at age 1 and 2 understand, but still we mean a little bit beyond that. So there is a concept called Higiyah Lufinuch, when kids get to be a certain age, whatever it is, which seems to vary from mitzvah to mitzvah, and you find actually lulav, for example, thank you for the show and tell, you find lulav being one of the examples in which you find chinuch brought up. In fact, the Gemara has, the Mishnah has this discussion of different mitzvahs or different shiurim that are given, different ages that are given based on what type of knowledge they need. So in the context of lulav, so the Gemara, the Mishnah says that katan shiyodeya l'naneya lochana lulav, a katan who is old enough to know how to shake a lulav, so then we start training him in shaking the lulav. And as the Rishonim discuss, it's interesting because really shaking the lulav is not necessary. It's an additional mitzvah, but you can be yotzei the mitzvah of lulav without shaking the lulav. So the Gemara actually, that's where we get into the whole question of the bracha, the whole difficulty we have, the whole idea of turning the esrog upside down, is because we want to have the bracha before the mitzvah. And the truth is the mitzvah is performed very simply, mitzvah nafik, as soon as you pick it up, the mitzvah is fulfilled. So if that's the case, why do we have to wait till a cousin knows how to shake the lulav? We know Katana much younger can lift things for sure. So we should start from the age of lifting. That's also be necessary in the mitzvah of lulav. So here the commentary is right. There's a whole mitzvah about this, that when we try to train children, we try to train them in the most ideal manner. We try to train them in a way that is really mohudr, is really appropriate, is really a way that they're going to try to do things in the most ideal fashion. So even if in theory the mitzvah could be fulfilled in a minimal fashion, with less than that, when we're training children, we want to do it in the most ideal fashion. So therefore we have this higher standard mentioned in the Mishnah, even though in theory the mitzvah ruach doesn't really require such a high standard. So both in the context of yeshiva sukkah and in the context of taking a lulav, so you find chinuch being a prominent concept and being built from there to many other mitzvahs. So to take a step back, to again bridge last week's zone to this week's zone, and then we'll continue in a third installment. So it is a concept that comes up by by Yom Kippur as well. As far as a positive sense, it comes up in the idea that we're told the Shir Fechinuch by Yom Kippur is much closer to adulthood, a year or two, depending on the stamina of the child before Bar Mitzvah, and then partial fast a year or two before that. But we're not talking about the age of 6 and 7, as we are by many other mitzvot. And it's generally assumed that when kids are younger than that, they really don't fast at all. It's ancient, the same story they tell about the Avnei Nezer. As we've mentioned in the past, the Avnei Nezer is always a favorite for stories that took place when he was very young, and the age keeps getting lower and lower. So we can say that when the Avnei Nezer was 2 weeks old, the following story was related about him, that he was eating on Yom Kippur because he was 2 weeks old. And, you know, a Shiloh that came up this past Yom Kippur, it was this past Shabbos, so there happens to be a machluk, suppose, what should happen if somebody has to eat on Yom Kippur. Let's say somebody is not well and needs to eat on Yom Kippur. So in general, it's a question, do they ever institute a concept of Kiddush for Yom Kippur since Yom Kippur is Yantar? But it's especially a question, it's past Yom Kippur since it was Shabbos, and we know that normally there is a concept of Kiddush on Shabbos. If one were eating on a normal Shabbos, one would have to make Kiddush first. So if one was eating this past Shabbos, which happened to be Yom Kippur as well, so even though most of us weren't going to be eating, but if you were, so is there an institution of Kiddush? You're not 1,000 machlokas, I suppose. So along similar lines, they asked the Avnei Nezer, when he was a kid, however old he was, he said, you're eating, you plan on reciting Kiddush. So he said, no, I'm not going to recite Kiddush. Why? Because why would I recite Kiddush? I'm a child. I'm 2 weeks old. Right? So why would I recite Kiddush? The only reason I would recite Kiddush, even though I'm not obligated in Kiddush, the only reason I would do this is because so when I grow up, I should know how to make Kiddush. I should know that when I eat on Yom Kippur, I should make Kiddush. But when I grow up, I don't plan on eating on Yom Kippur, so therefore I don't see any reason to make Kiddush now. So that was part of the Avnei Nezer's approach towards the whole idea of Chinuch. And that's a concept when it comes into Yom Kippur. So we have Chinuch as far as fasting really at a much higher age, very close to Bar Mitzvah. And the younger age, the kids are all eating. So the question is, what exactly is the mechanism for that? And I think we started to explain this a little bit last week, and it's like, Tasha, this is what I'm talking about. There's a lot of interesting discussions related to it, so we'll talk about this wing of the discussion now, as far as Chinuch is concerned, and then after that, maybe we'll go into other topics of Chinuch that are more general. So the question that's raised has to do with a debate among the Rishonim. Even though when we talk about chinuch, so there's different levels of chinuch. There is the active encouragement of children to do mitzvos. So that's generally taken to be a mitzvah sasei. It's generally taken to be a rabbinical mitzvah. The overall training of children to be religious is a mitzvah sasei menatar, shinan to move on nefa, as the Achronim explained. But the specific training of mitzvahs is a mitzvah derabbanan. But there is the issue, what do you have children who are doing things wrong? Say, cotton also in the veilus. That's a discussion in the Gemara. If you have a cotton who's eating non-kosher food, so even though, strictly speaking, he has no responsibility for his actions, he's a child, but should the parents say, no, that's not for you, you should stop you from eating that. And there's a discussion in the Gemara. Should Bezdin do this? Should parents stop the child? So that's a discussion in the Gemara. And in any event, it comes out that certainly for the parent to feed the child non-kosher food, so that's inappropriate. That's what's called Issa Lasafos, the Katan Biadayin, that to feed a child something that's prohibited actively, to actively give him a non-kosher food, that's certainly wrong. And that's very possibly wrong, even on the level of Menhatar. That's a little bit of discussion, but the Gemara connects it to Psukim, the Gemara in Yevamos, and the Midrashim. Seems to be that it's perhaps an Issa Menhatar. It's interesting, actually, just again, to maybe bring in a little bit more Sukkah material on this point. So that whole Gemara that we mentioned a few minutes ago about Hilani Malka, that Hilani was worried about Sukkah because of her children. So there is a discussion about this, because the impression we get from the Gemara of Masechus Nozir is that the obligation of Chinuch is really only on the father. So if the obligation is on the father, so why is Gemara again? The question goes back to where it started. Why are we talking about Hilani Malka as the model? She's not really obligated in Sukkah, she's not obligated in Chinuch either. So there is a discussion. Some explain that there is a little bit of a question how we relate to the mitzvah of Sukkah. And on the surface, Sukkah is a mitzvah sasei, a positive mitzvah. But on the other hand, it seems to be almost, you can have the Nezer about this, it seems to phrase it very strongly, it seems to be almost a quasi-prohibition. that eating outside of the sukkah is a, what do you want to call it, an issur asay, or you want to call it almost like a lo asay, that there's a positive mitzvah to eat in the sukkah, which ends up creating a prohibition, so to speak, in the Torah doesn't really phrase it that way, of eating outside the sukkah. So you have whether it's a bittul asay, a negation of the mitzvah asay, or a actual prohibition that somehow is between the lines, eating outside the sukkah takes on the status of a negative mitzvah to a certain degree, at least the way some Achronim understood. I think we may have mentioned in the past, maybe in connection of shofar. Did we talk about shofar this year? Maybe in the connection of shofar in the past, we talked about the fact that there is a discussion, we have a concept of mitzvah abal bi'aveira, again, as a source that's based in sukkah. Again, based on sukkah's concept, that normally if you perform a mitzvah through a transgression, the model usually is given a stolen object, so then generally the mitzvah is not effective. So if I steal a lulav, that's really where it comes from, the Tariq Lulav HaGazel, the famous Tariq that we studied in yeshivas, some yeshivas, is based on that concept that, well, stolen lulav is no good. So the Gemara has a pasuk in the beginning of Masechta Sukkah on Daf Tes, in the first Tariq, the Gemara learns from the pasuk that you can't be yotze with a stolen sukkah. With a stolen sukkah, it's not effective for the mitzvah. So the Tosfos asks over there in Sukkah on Daf Tes, well, we know that already. We know, we have a concept of mitzvah babi aveira. I can't have a stolen lulav, I can't have a stolen sukkah either. So Tosfos has one answer to that question. Tosfos raises that question, but the Menchas Chinuch had a different answer. The Menchas Chinuch suggested that when it comes to sukkah, you have a number of different levels. On the one hand, you have an obligation to eat in a sukkah. On the other hand, you have, however it turns out, basically some type of prohibition to eat outside of a sukkah. So mitzvah, babi aveira, what does that do? That cancels out my mitzvah. It means I can't score points for doing a positive action. So if I were to have a stolen sukkah, so what would that mean practically? You would mean, okay, mitzvah, babi aveira, I'm not impressing God with this at all. This doesn't count at all for a mitzvah. But is it like eating in my living room? Am I committing this prohibition of eating outside the sukkah? So on the surface, you would say no, because you're eating in a sukkah. It's not a sukkah that's giving you points, but it's not considered eating outside the sukkah. So says the Menachas Chinuch, that was before the pasuk. Since the pasuk comes and says a stolen sukkah is no good, that's to tell you that a stolen sukkah is like your living room. It has no value at all. It's the same thing as eating outside. So what you see from that, at least theoretical, breakdown in the Menachas Chinuch is that you can maybe separate the parts. You have an active mitzvah to eat in the sukkah, and you have, perhaps separately, a losa say to eat outside of the sukkah, and they could maybe in theory be separated, and that's what this pasuk is going to tell us, that they're going to be connected. So how exactly you relate to this idea is a question, but different formulations in Achronim, how strongly you want to phrase it is kind of a quasi-prohibition. But there are those who suggest that that's what the Gemara is talking about when it comes to Hilani. That when Hilani said that when the Gemara tells us Hilani was concerned about her children eating in the sukkah, even though she's not theoretically responsible for chinuch, so the Achronim say no, but this is basically what they'll also say. This is as if they're eating non-kosher food, and therefore the mother for sure is obligated in that, because the husband is obligated in that. Really, everybody's obligated to try to worry about the children that they shouldn't be doing the wrong thing, not just that they should be doing the right thing. And therefore, eating outside the sukkah kind of has that status. And this is all related to this idea the Gemara has, that to feed a katan something prohibited is certainly not allowed. And the question is to go further than that, do we actively stop them or not? So this comes into the discussion that I mentioned last week when it comes to Yom Kippur, because there is a little bit of unclarity, and it seems to be a big machlokas by Rishonim. How do we relate to the inuyim outside of Achil and Shtiyah? So we assume that certainly it's Asum and Atorah to eat and drink on Yom Kippur, but what about the other four inuyim? Basically, four other inuyim that are prohibited on Yom Kippur. So the Gemara connects them to Pesukim, but there is some discussion whether that's really a genuine learning out from Pesukim, the Gemara Nayin Dalet, Nayin Hey, and Yuma, or do we assume maybe that these are asmachtas, these are not really genuinely mudim, and that actually these inuyim are derabbanan. So that was a question that was debated among the Rishonim, and there's a mysterious Ran. The Ran has a long comment about this. It's not clear what his conclusion is. Because he starts off saying that it sounds like it's Taraisa. Then he asks a question on that view. And you can't tell from the way he ends. He's saying, okay, because my question is so strong, therefore it must be the Rabbanan. Or is he saying that, no, I still hold the Raisa, but I have to figure out what the answer to this question is. So if you read all the Afronim, half the Afronim say one way, half the Afronim say the other way. They'll throw the Ran in column A, they'll throw the Ran in column B, depending on who it is, without even explaining it too much. It's really unclear how the Ran concludes on this point. So what's the passage that bothers him so much? Since that generally we don't have kids fasting on Yom Kippur, that much we know. But that could be a separate issue. But we don't have them worry about any vinuyim as far as bathing or as far as anointing themselves. So we allow Ketanim to do this on Yom Kippur. And if you're going to tell me that really this is essentially an issue in HaTorah, so then the question is, how could we allow it? So that those who say, well, yeah, it must be a Darabonah for that reason. Also the fact that the Mishnah says that we allow a king and a bride. There's a Mishnah in Yuma that says, that they're allowed to wash their face. So that shows you that it must be this is a Darabonah, because if this is Daraisa, so how could we allow leniencies for kings and for brides who have a different standard of how they're going to appear in public? How could we be more lenient on them unless we're going to say that all these are really midrabbanim? The Or Gadol is a commentary on the Mishnah is called the Or Gadol, written by the Minsker Gadol, Wilhelm Perlman. So he writes there that the idea of washing your face, he says that could be that it's just a chatzi shir. That maybe we could say that washing really is an issum ha'tara, but that the type of affliction the Torah is trying to say, the type of tainug that the Torah is trying to prohibit when it comes to washing, is washing the whole body. So if you're not going to wash the whole body, anything less than that is actually a chatzi shir. It's maybe a subject to a certain amount of leniency, even if it isn't a siddurah or the other renewal. But in any event, this was a debate among the Rishonim and among the Achronim. Are the Inuyim Daraisa and Darabanan, or Darabanan? And the question is, if we assume that they're Min HaTorah, how could we allow Ketanim to partake of these Inuyim? So there are various answers that you find in the Avraham. One of the popular ones, the Magen Avraham has an approach like this. Rosh Sternbach has a discussion about this in his farm, and he has a number of his answers as well, is that you could say that the whole concept doesn't apply to something that is temporary. If you have a prohibition that's temporary, then this whole idea doesn't really kick in. So when does it kick in? It kicks in. If you're going to feed your kids ham sandwiches and pork and cheeseburgers until they become bar mitzvah, and then all of a sudden they're going to try to kick the habit, it's going to be very hard for them. But if you make them eat on Yom Kippur, so it's the same kind of eating they do the whole rest of the year. It's just this day they're not going to do it. So as it is, the whole temporary thing changes when they get older. So there's no reason to impose upon them something that's tied into the day. They'll deal with that day when it comes up when they're adults. And on a different level, it also means that, and this is a little bit of a metaphysical lumbster question, that there is an assumption that if something is only temporarily prohibited, it means that it's not actually bad, which is a questionable assumption, but there are those who make this assumption. So they could say that pork, for example, that's bad necessity. God wants us to really not eat. But, say, food on Yom Kippur doesn't all of a sudden become bad. The same food that's good all year round doesn't all of a sudden become bad on Yom Kippur. It must be that it's neutral because it was fine the day before and it's fine tomorrow. It's just that we're prohibited to eat it. So anything that's neutral, so since children aren't obligated in these mitzvahs anyway, so there's no reason to keep them away from these neutral items. It's only when it comes to something that's inherently harmful. So then, even though children don't have mitzvahs, we want to keep them away from these harmful things. If it's not in the substance, sorry? Oh, so that question is raised. That's exactly. So some raise the objection. I think maybe Rosh Sternbach has this, or maybe some other Achronim have this question, that we do find this idea by Shabbos. So when it comes to children, so we do tell them that they're not allowed to do malacha on Shabbos. And if that's the case, so that seems to say that even something that's temporarily prohibited, we prohibit to children as well. So there are various approaches to this. I've heard them discuss this question in light of this answer, and they have a number of answers. One of the strongest answers is it could be that Shabbos is a whole different day, and that's why we actually have a separate pasuk for Shabbos. But the pasuk says that not just you, but you and your household and all of your children. So it could be that that's down to the point, that were it simply that we have this general din of not feeding them non-kosher food, so then maybe Shabbos would indeed be excluded to Shabbos's temporary, is one day a week. But since we have a special pasuk, then it could be that Shabbos is only included because of that special pasuk. Could also be that there's lots of question about how we relate to Shabbos. Is Shabbos an idea that the whole world should be at rest, or is it an idea that there's a chiyuv for us to rest, which is an interesting concept in itself. Maybe we could talk about that sometime at the end, because it's an interesting sub-question. But in any event, that question that certainly is raised on this answer. If you say this answer, temporary Yisurim don't apply, so how do you deal with Shabbos? So probably the easiest way to deal with it is the fact that Shabbos has its own pasuk. I think Mr. Weiser was first.
What about children bathing on Shabbos? And therefore you have to wash before you go to the mikveh too.
Why were we talking about the mikveh and Shabbos for children?
Yeah.
For chassidisha. Are we talking about the chassidisha practices? What's the concern?
I'll wash it on Shabbos.
Why did you bring up mikvah?
Because that's one of the things that is in our mind.
You think so? If a child wants to go to the mikvah on Shabbos?
Oh, the child has bathing the child on Shabbos. So why couldn't you bathe him on Shabbos?
You're saying as far as hot water, as far as going into it?
As far as bathing, just in general.
Well, bathing by itself is not really a prohibition on Shabbos. There's certain abundance involved going into the water completely, things like that. Is that what you're referring to? You're saying?
Well, just bathing in general.
On your kippur is an issue.
Well, on your kippur, there's no question.
Well, we do do it on your kippur. That's the question. So the question is, since we do
right,
so we do do it on your kippur, so... Well, so the Kohen Inyan is total, that's a separate thing. The question is for children. Children do bathe on Yom Kippur, even though adults can't. The question is, how do we allow the child to do this if normally we can't feed them non-kosher food? So why are we allowed to bathe inside is one of the questions. So one of the answers is that maybe it's this temporary concept. And the question is, so how does that relate to Shabbos? And that's got us on that point. Hi. The question is, it possible for... Okay, so there's a couple of good points in what you're reading. A couple of, three points, three angles at least to connect to. And what your next point is that, first of all, Engozrim may not be the right concept, though, because Engozrim referred to the rabbis making a decree. And presumably, we're assuming that to give children non-kosher food is probably an instrument in Hataras. So it may not be the right angle to come at it from. But still, nonetheless, the question is, the impossibility of children fasting is certainly acknowledged. And we'll have to discuss that. So we're not even dealing yet with them eating and drinking, because that we're taking for granted. Why, we'll come back to. But first, as far as the other things, that's what we're trying to deal with. Now, the fact that it may cause rebellion, which is a broader issue, is also an interesting question as far as how that relates to chinuch, and maybe that we'll talk about when we come to the broader chinuch discussion. But just in a more local sense, forget about causing rebellion if they're not going to make it through Yom Kippur. You know, that's the problem. So how does that relate? So let's see how that fits into the different distortions. So one idea is this idea of it being temporary. Another idea that you find, and this has a number of different formulations, is that we don't prohibit something for a child in the sense of this type of prohibition that we're talking about, unless it would be a comparable experience. So if there's a radical difference between the way a child would relate to it and the way an adult would relate to it, so then we don't have such a concept. So to tell an adult not to eat pork and to tell a child not to eat pork is basically the same idea. But to tell a child to fast is very different than telling an adult to fast. And on the flip side, to tell them to abstain from washing and from anointing, so that's also very different. And there's an interesting discussion about this when Shuvah's Goran does it. You almost think he's half joking. He says, just look at how kids react when you try to bathe them, you try to put oil in them, they run away. So an adult wants to do this, and a kid would love, the best thing in the world would be to roll around in the mud. So I'm almost not sure whether he's serious about this point or not, but it's a way of illustrating the fact that kids relate to this very differently to adults. So it doesn't make sense to apply this concept. This concept only makes sense to apply when it's something that's comparable to both. So, because it's going to be a radically different type of experience, then we wouldn't apply it. So that could also be relevant to the broader fasting question. And there are those who suggest that the whole idea is that since you can't have a child fasting completely, because they can't abstain from eating and drinking all this time, so therefore to have a chinuch with a half fast, if it's not going to be the whole experience, and there's no point in doing it partially. So then that raises the question a little bit. When we say they can't fast, is that the problem? They can't physically make it through? So is it an idea of pikuach nefesh? So that was a whole discussion. There's some sources that sound like it's really only pikuach nefesh that allows the child to eat and drink on Yom Kippur, because otherwise it should be included in this prohibition of giving children, so to speak, non-kosher food. And that's a very difficult presumption. To say they were only feeding ketanim because of pikuach nefesh, there's some sources that sound like that, and other sources that argue vehemently against that type of idea. Partially so vehemently because they're afraid of the attitude it may lead to, that if you're only going to feed your kids when it looks like they're not going to survive otherwise, so then that's not really a very healthy approach. So there are some who say in economics, they put those two ideas together. And really we're only feeding the children because they can't survive without it. But if we're going to be so medactic about it like we are with adults with that approach, so then it's practically really going to be dangerous. So we put the two ideas together, and because we're worried about their health, so we make them eat, but because we're worried about how that plays out, so that if we don't treat it like a pikuach nefesh hetzer, we treat it like an across-the-board hetzer. So that's the kasha of the Achron Mask. But if it's all a pikuach nefesh idea, so then why don't we try feeding them in shiurim, try giving them less than a kedayas, and we don't find that approach. So it doesn't seem to be that that's what it's based on. It seems to be that it's something else, and it's part of the discussion. Hi. So another fact that some raise here is the fact that it could be that the Surim of Yom Kippur, particularly the Inuyim, you could even say this also by even the fast, but the other Inuyim are basically phrased like an Isra Aseh, like a positive mitzvah. The idea of the Nisim Asnaf Shaseichem, that you shall afflict yourselves. So therefore, this basically presents itself as a positive mitzvah. So there are those who suggest that the whole idea of not feeding ketanim prohibited substances, that's only true if it's a prohibition, but if it's a positive mitzvah, so then this prohibition doesn't apply at all. So this is actually invoked a lot in another discussion that draws upon a lot of these same svaras. It happens every Friday night, or any Friday night, every Friday night in shul, so they recite Kiddush. So that's a whole discussion how that minhag came about. In the Gemara, that minhag is based on the assumption that people are eating in the shul. Nowadays, we don't assume that people are eating in the shul Friday night, but there's a minhag, which is really separate from that Gemara discussion. The minhag developed that some people have and some people don't have, but many shuls have a minhag to recite Kiddush in shul Friday night. So the question is, so what happens with the wine? So there's an obligation normally to taste from the wine that's used for Kiddush, but it's not really right to drink from that wine because the Kiddush that's being made in shul is not effective in being matir the Suda, because it's not the place where the Suda is being eaten. So therefore, it's not from welcome Suda, so the person who's making the Kiddush is not really in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Kiddush, and therefore shouldn't eating, shouldn't drink the wine. So our practice is to give the wine to the children, as the children should drink from the wine. So the whole discussion, how do you allow that? If the adults can't drink the wine, so how are we able to feed the wine to the children? It should be part of this whole concept of not feeding children things that are prohibited. So there are a number of approaches to this that also fit in with the approaches that we've been talking about. First of all, here the whole assumption of our Yom Kippur discussion is that this doesn't apply to the Rabbanans, which is the view of the Rashba. That this doesn't apply to the Rabbanans. So if it applies equally to the Raisas and the Rabbanans, so then you wouldn't have this whole question of the Ran saying how could it be that the prohibitions are deraisa and that we're not allowed to feed them. So apparently he's assuming that it doesn't apply if prohibitions are derabbanan. So if that's the case, that really helps very much for the whole Kiddush thing anyway. But in addition to that, there are those who point out that first answer he said, that's a temporary issue. There's nothing inherently wrong with the wine, at least from a halakhic view, if not from a legal view. There's nothing inherently wrong with feeding the wine to the child. It's only at this point in time that it's a problem, before Kiddush Friday night. And if that's the case, it should fit into that idea. And there are others who say, what is this? This is an essay. How is it an essay? Because it all flows from the mitzvah of Kiddush. You have a mitzvah essay to make Kiddush. And that we assume has to be makom suda, which could itself be a drabanan, as discussed in the past. And so therefore, to eat now before Kiddush is a lack in Kiddush makom suda. It's not a prohibition anywhere. It's somehow a function of an assay. And therefore, if that's missing, so then that's what's wrong with eating at that time. So if we say that this whole concept doesn't apply to a mitzvah assay, so then we should perhaps not apply the concept to feeding it to children, and it's the same idea that you find by Yom Kippur. It's interesting to say that that's what's going on when it comes to Yom Kippur, because it also raises the question that maybe it should be a mitzvah say shaz man grama. Maybe we should assume that women should be exempt. There's a whole discussion in the literature why it is that we don't assume like that. Why don't we say that the other inuim should be a mitzvah say shaz man grama, and women should be off the hook? But some say that's the proof that they're the rabbanim, because if they were the right, so then you would say yes, they are off the hook. And that would be strange. You'd have men having a different type of fast than women would have, and if you're going to say that the obligation of women would be drabanan and men would be daraisa, that would be odd, especially because generally when we talk about mitzvah say shaz man grama, we don't assume women are chayav drabanan. We assume they're completely off the hook. So that would be a very strange formulation, the fact that we don't see that, so therefore that's how some bring a riot the whole institution of drabanan, and therefore it was applied equally to men and to women. Others who say that even if a specific derivation is from the mitzvah saseh, is from the positive commandment, nonetheless, it all ties into the overall concept of Yom Kippur and the fast of Yom Kippur, which women are equally obligated in, and therefore all the details all fall into place together with that. So various approaches to that question. I remember when I was in high school, I saw the Chachma Shlomo on the bottom of Shulchan Aruch has a discussion of this as well, and he had an answer which I thought was so hard to understand that I couldn't what he was getting at. So I was, at the time I was applying for yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, so I had Rabbi Blachman from Karen Biavna had come to America to give interviews, so I wanted to ask him this question. He said, explain to me what this Marashal means, this Chachma Shlomo. I don't get it. And so he said, we talk about it later. And I remember a year later in Eretz Yisrael, we started talking about what this Marashal meant. Very, very surprising idea. Marashal says that it's kind of an extension of the idea we mentioned before, that the concept only applies to, concept only applies if it's going to make sense to children as well. If it's not the same thing for children as it is for adults, then it shouldn't apply. It says, so therefore, Yom Kippur is not really going to work out for kids, because, as is often said in the Achronim, in general, you don't have a prohibition of eating on Yom Kippur. Why? Well, in structure, we basically don't, because the prohibition on Yom Kippur is really to break the fast. You have a mitzvah, as we said, a positive mitzvah to fast. And the prohibition of eating is not really a prohibition of eating. It's a prohibition of breaking the fast. And that's why the shear for Yom Kippur is different. Whenever we talk about eating, we talk about eating matzah, we talk about being punished for eating treif, we're always talking about a kezias. We assume that eating means to consume a kezias. When it comes to Yom Kippur, the shear is higher than that, because the Torah never says don't eat. The shear Torah says afflict yourself, fast, and don't break the fast. So apparently if you're going to have a kezias in Yom Kippur, you'll still be pretty miserable. You're still not going to lose your affliction. So it's only when you get a little higher than that, what's called a kosevis, so the larger shear, that's when you start to feel a little bit satisfied. Anything less than that is not the full shear on Yom Kippur. So therefore, what is the prohibition on Yom Kippur? The prohibition on Yom Kippur is not eating. Prohibition is what's known in Hebrew as Yishuv Hadas, in Aramaic as Yituve Daita, basically being settled, that your mind should be at ease, so to speak, Yishuv Hadas. So the Chachma Shlomo says, and I thought this was really hard to understand at the time, that children don't have das, which we normally means is a different usage of the term. That das normally refers to a fully formed intellect, and it's the type of awareness you need in order to make a business deal, in order to purchase something, in order to perform mitzvahs. So we generally assume that when you become bar mitzvahs, so that's the age when people are competent, so to speak. So you say, less than that, before bar mitzvah, children don't have this level of mental competency, and so it means children don't have das. So, says the Marashal, Also, the prohibition in Yom Kippur means to have Yishuv Hadas, your Das should be settled, and children don't have Das, the whole concept doesn't apply to them, which I suppose is a very hard idea to understand. Yishuv Hadas is a different usage of the word. It means to feel satisfied. It means not to feel hungry. It doesn't refer to anything intellectual. Children certainly know how to tell when they're hungry and when they're not hungry. So that's a hard idea to understand. Rav Blachman had a somewhat more analytical spin on it, but it is a little bit of a difficult idea to understand. In general, Rav Sternbach doesn't like any of those approaches when you say that it's no Isra Achila. So even though the Torah doesn't phrase it as an Isra Achila, basically at the end of the day, it boils down to a prohibition of eating, and that's basically going to be the case. It's as if the Torah says don't eat, even though we're not going to use measurements of kazayas, but we've interpreted inui as eating, and as abstaining from eating, and therefore that's essentially what it means. So to have all these approaches, for the Torah doesn't actually say don't eat, it's a hard approach to take. So what's the story then when we say whether it's d'raisa or d'rabbanan? As far as we knew, to wrap up that point before we'll wrap up this wing, and then we'll talk about the rest of the thing later. So it's not clear from the Ran, it's a debate in the Rishonim. So the Beis Yosef suggests that maybe the resolution is the same type of resolution that we find to the Chol HaMoed, which again is a timely topic. There's a discussion that Gemara has in the Maseches Chagiga and Daf Yud Ches, and there's a posters about this which really spells this out, that even though we don't always perceive this properly, but there really is a prohibition of malacha on Chol HaMoed. We often relate to Chol HaMoed like it's a weekday, but it's not really the case. There is a prohibition of malacha. It just tends to manifest itself very differently because we're driving around and we're using electricity and we're doing a lot of the things that we never do on Shabbos or Yom Tov. So we don't remember that there is a prohibition of malacha. But there is a prohibition. There are a lot of things we don't do on Chol HaMoed. So it happens to be that the prohibition of malacha on Shabbos manifests itself differently than it does even on Yom Tov, the difference between Yom Tov and Shabbos, as we know. And Chol HaMoed is certainly a very different definition of malacha. So the Tosfos raises the question, so what is malacha's Chol HaMoed? On the one hand, it seems to be it's a prohibition of HaTorah. That's the impression we get from the Chumash. On the other hand, the way the Gemara deals with it, and all these very complicated Gemaras in the first half of Mordechai is half about Avelos, that's the second half of it, and the first half is all about Chol HaMoed. So Chol HaMoed really, at least when you initially look at it, is a very hard sugya. There's a lot of complicated Gemaras in the first half of Mordechai trying to figure out what you can't do on Chol HaMoed. And those Gemaras, it sometimes seems like you're dealing with an Issa D'Rabbanan, the type of Heterim, as I mentioned to you earlier, we talked about Logazra, the different types of attitudes we take towards the Raisas and the Rabbanim. And if you read the Gemara's about Chol HaMoed, so it kind of sounds like they're the Rabbanim. So what is it? Is it the Raisa or is it the Rabbanim? So the Yisod that we got from Tosis and the Gemara over there in Chagiga is that there is kind of an in-between status. That there are ideas that are essentially Min HaTorah, and their weight is Min HaTorah, but Chazal were given the authority to not only apply existing halachas, but really to define the format it's going to take. And it's called Masr HaKashuv L'Chachamim, that Chachamim were given the authority to say, okay, take this concept and run with it. So again, another timely reference, the Chacham Tzvi writes in his Shuvas, that this is also relevant, this is also the idea behind the Psulim of Elulav and Esrog. And so we have a lot of things, as we know, that disqualify Elulav and Esrog, very, very complicated Gemaras in Sukkah. As to what makes a lulav unqualified, what makes an esrog unqualified. So how do you know this from the Torah? Does the Torah spell out these things? What does the Torah say? The Torah says, you know, priya tadar, it's got to be beautiful, so maybe on some level something that's qualitatively not tadar is not acceptable. But for the most part, these concepts don't seem to be spelled out in Chumash. So what are we saying? We say that there's a disqualification of the esrog or of the lulav. So are we saying that that's really okay in HaTorah, but just Rabbanan it's not okay? Or are we saying that somewhere this is alluded to in the Chumash itself? So the Chacham Tzvi writes, this is the same idea of Masr HaKashuv L'Chachamim, that the Torah says you have to have a lulav and esrog, and Chazal were given the authority to a certain extent to define where it stops being a kosher esrog, where it stops being a kosher lulav, and therefore essentially dealing with deraisas, even though it doesn't really say it in the Chumash. So to hear, that's what the Beis Yosef writes, but that's the idea when it comes to the Inuyim as well. The Torah says you have to afflict yourself on Yom Kippur. And how exactly that plays out, at least separate from the idea of eating and drinking, but the other concepts, how that plays out, so that was given over to Chazal to determine. That was Masur HaKasuk V'Chamim. Chazal were able to decide what's that going to mean, practically speaking. So that was how the Beis Yosef addressed this rhyme that left us hanging. So I have all these questions. Is it Tzaisa Zavon? So basically the rabbis were able to define it, so that could allow for a certain leniencies perhaps, or for certain rules that we wouldn't expect, while at the same time maintaining a structure that I saw, but then maybe being different for children. So that could perhaps address some of how Yom Kippur is affecting the whole under Bar Mitzvah population. So how's that population affected by all the other mitzvahs? So that's what we'll talk about in a separate discussion about Chinuch. So it's, we have Margaret here, it's downstairs. Okay, so just to quickly review some of the key points that we spoke about. So we spoke about some of the ideas of chinuch in general, how the Gemara brings up the concept in Sukkah in a number of contexts, how Hilni Malka is brought as a proof for some of the dinim of Sukkah, even though she's not obligated, but her children are obligated. And then we talked about how the idea of the Mishnah talking about Katan Shiadeel and Anea is obligated in Lula, even though you could be also a little much less than that. We talked a little bit about why is Hilni the model if she's a woman and women are not really obligating the chinuch. We talked a little bit about the whole idea of Sukkah being somewhat of a positive mitzvah, somewhat of a negative mitzvah, and the whole ramifications to that mitzvah above the Aveira. And the idea that mothers are for sure obligated in keeping their kids away from Averis. And so the question that comes up, so why are mothers allowed to bathe their children and anoint them on Yom Kippur, if that's Asim and HaTorah? So the question was, that itself was Machlokas Rishonim, some said it was Asim HaTorah, and the Ran wasn't sure because of this question. And so we talked about some of the approaches to that. We talked about the idea of a temporary Yisr. Maybe the whole concept doesn't apply to temporary Yisr. The question was raised only about Shabbos. Shabbos may be a different din. We talked about the question of it being a Yisr which doesn't relate to children the same way. And we talked about how children don't want to get take baths or be oiled, and how that may represent the fact that the Yisr just doesn't make sense to them. It seems on the same level. We talked about the concept of being Yisr Aseh, how that could affect the question of Mitzvah Seishaz Mangrama, various discussions of whether women really are obligated in the Torah and all of the Inuyim the same way, and presumably yes, but why should that be the case? And then how that relates to the concept of giving children from the Kiddush wine to drink Friday night. What is that, why is that allowed? Why is that not like feeding them non-kosher food? And there also the fact that it's abundant and temporary, and it's just say, all seems to help. And we talked about the Maharshal's approach that the whole list on Kippur, there shouldn't be have Yishuv Hadas, and Ketanim don't have Das. And then we talked about this question, Masur HaKasul V'Chachamim, this in-between state where Chazal are given the authority to define what Mitzvahs Min HaTorah mean, which could be relevant to Inuyim of Yom Kippur, but it's also especially relevant now in two senses. One, in that it could be how Malachas Chalamoi is defined, and also how the Pesulim of Luv and Esrog are defined, which again are both areas in which presumably are Dinim Min HaTorah, and yet the way they are played out have rabbinical quality to them, could be because it's again a example of this Masur HaKasuv V'Chachamim. Anybody who's further interested in that topic of Masur HaKasuv V'Chachamim, with David Cohen and his favorite Gvul Yavik, sends a very lengthy essay where he collected every single example anywhere where something is suggested to Masur HaKasuv V'Chachamim, and he comes up with like 50, 60 different things, which, at least according to one opinion here or there, may be Masur HaKasuv V'Chachamim. So we mentioned three or four, Chalmoid and Psuliluv and Inuyim Kippurim. If you look hard enough, you could find 45, 50 other possible examples. Okay, it should be a wonderful Chag Sameach, a wonderful Yom Tov for everybody. It should be the only good things, Mazel and Bracha. And we will see you, I guess, in like, 3 weeks, or two weeks. Yeah,
next week, yeah,
2 weeks. 2 weeks, okay. Have a wonderful Yom Tov. A wonderful Yom Tov.
I still got my question. You're a lot of days on Shabbos. As long as you don't want to